Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, John Crowley.
And me, Hannah Storm. In our podcasts, we speak with colleagues from across our journalism industry about the stories they've covered and their own stories as well. We hear from them about how our industry is adapting to the realisation that it needs to take discussions around mental health more seriously and how journalism can shape and normalise conversations around well-being.
Hannah and I are both directors of Headlines Network and long-time journalists. Journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in, wherever they work.
For this episode, we're speaking with Gina Chua, the newly appointed executive editor of Semaphore and former executive editor at Reuters, where she spent many years managing safety conversations for the global news agency. As one of the most high-profile, openly trans women in media, she recently found herself sharing her own story after a career sharing the stories of others. Gina, thanks so much for joining us. How did you come to that decision?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I could not come to that decision. I think that's a sort of a backwards kind of question. I think that the real question is, how did I take so long to come to that decision? And I think the short answer is because I'm a coward. I've certainly felt this way for a long time. At least I've felt disquiet about who I was for a long time. And I think maybe over the last 10, 15 or more years, I came to understand who I was. But honestly, 15 years ago was not a good time to transition. I'm not sure now is a good time to transition, but it's a better time than then. And so I think it was one of those decisions that I made probably 3 or 4 years ago that this was a path I wanted to explore. And that I had friends who had done it and they hadn't lost their jobs, they haven't been killed, touch wood, and they hadn't suffered significantly for it or for that matter even at all. And then so it became something I could actually explore seriously. And then, you know, and then I made a decision probably about 2.5 years ago that it was something I was definitely going to do. The pandemic came. Sort of I felt really sort of cheated out of the whole thing with the pandemic. But it turned out the pandemic was, in fact, a good time to transition. I mean, that's not to take away the horrific nature of it for some people who can't and who were trapped in situations. But for me, it was a real chance to sort of ease into this new skin at home, you know, where people only see you through a small little window on a screen. And it turned out to be the perfect environment for a slow and easy transition.
Gosh, it strikes me that, you know, you use the word coward and I can't even begin to imagine how difficult it must have been, but I can't see that any other word other than using the word incredibly brave for what you've been through.
It sounds nice, and once you've done it, it's sort of, you know, it's what being trans is one of those things, it's very hard to take back. Even if you are, you know, one of those very small minority of people that detransition, you know, the fact is everybody knows, because being trans is a very public statement, because it's identity as opposed to orientation. You can be gay, and whether you're in the closet or not, you don't actually have to tell people about it very much, and frankly it's none of their business. But if you are trans, you are in some ways asking the world to accept you as you are in a different way from what they thought, and that means you have to be public about it. So once you've made that decision, it's very hard to really walk it back. You know, as I tell people, you know, I've always been trans, it's just that you found out about it last year. But I mean, just in terms of sort of the bravery of it, which I don't particularly feel brave about it, you know, I think one of the things that my little network of trans friends all agree on is that, you know, we step on the shoulders of those who came before us. And those were very brave people. And they took on the world at a time when it was not easy. And they did it nonetheless, and they made it easier for the rest of us. So we really owe a debt to that generation before us.
You mentioned before that you transitioned during the pandemic and that in some ways made the steps easier, that people saw you through the screen and they began to see you in the way that you saw yourself. But isolation during the pandemic was absolutely acute, and many of us were really disconnected from our colleagues, weren't they? So what was the response to you sharing your journey with folks at Reuters when you told them?
It was fantastic. Reuters, wonderful institution, and you know, and everyone was incredibly welcoming, outpouring support. I had all these people write to me, I had some colleagues and some friends, you know, talk about people they knew who were on the same journey, children, relatives, in some cases they themselves were exploring. It was really nice to be able to, I don't know, be visible for them so that they could see, you know, someone else do it. But it is true, obviously, that the pandemic was a really terrible time for so many people. And that's not even talking about the illness and death and so on. I mean, just the psychological impact is huge. And there were so many people, certainly LGBT people, who were isolated in situations where they couldn't express themselves, they couldn't be out, or they were in situations that were not healthy. I had you could say any experience is good in the pandemic, but I certainly had a better experience than most. And that's partly because I was in an environment that was very supportive and have a wonderful partner.
Gina, you've spoken before about being on a private internal exploratory journey. And you said there earlier, this took several years. And now that you've kind of moved out of the shadows into the sunlight, tell us how that feels now.
It feels a little hot now that it's in the summer in New York. No, it's difficult to explain, other than I think to sort of say it's both exhilarating and incredibly just normal and mundane. And, you know, and it is really the idea that you don't have to compartmentalize your life. You don't have to juggle. You don't have to think about what you're telling, you know, your colleagues you did last weekend. You don't have to worry that someone might see you. I think I've said this before. It's sort of standing by the door of my apartment about to go out and, you know, listening for footsteps in case someone was in the building and I needed to get past them. It's getting out of bed and doing the laundry. It's come to the point, not exactly yet, because I'm only about a year and a half into sort of a public transition, but it is going to come to a point, I hope, where this isn't an issue anymore than you wake up and say, oh, look, I'm a man. How do I feel about that? It's like, okay, I'm just me. Or, you know, you wake up and you say, I'm a woman. But I think this idea that you can just be yourself, and I think that we use a lot of big words. We talk about our authentic self and so on, and all of those words are meaningful and they are true. But sometimes it's just really the simple things. It's that you can just talk to your friends and be who you are. If you're gay and you have a same-sex partner, you know, you want to be able to bring them to the office party. You want to introduce them to your friends. You want your mom to know them, right? And when you can't, that just imposes this tax on your brain, and you keep thinking, well, what can I say? How do I introduce this person? You know, what do I tell people I did over the weekend? You know, your mind just sort of starts to fracture. And when you don't have to do that, it's normal, which is what is great about it.
We're going to talk about your storied career shortly. But first, can I take you back to your upbringing? You grew up in a Catholic household in Singapore, attended high school in the Philippines. I come from an Irish Catholic background, so I know tons about being brought up in a conservative setting. Can you describe what that was like growing up?
You know, I mean, it was not bad. I mean, I have loving parents. All right, they're Catholic. you know, can't all be perfect. I went to a Catholic all-boys school, and I had a great time. What really, I think, changed my life dramatically was my parents moved to the Philippines when I was 15. And I went to an international school, which is a very different environment. It was co-ed, it was much more open. And then, you know, I was lucky enough to go to university in the US when I was still relatively young. And I think that all were very formative experiences. But I went back to Singapore 2 months ago, stopped in, caught up with my friends from school, all of the grown-up boys now, although in fact they are grown-up boys now. And they were incredibly welcoming. Singapore was a really interesting place for me to go back and sort of just see what had changed and what hadn't changed, and see where my story had taken me. So that was a sort of a really life-affirming and wonderful trip.
Gina, previously you said that you'd use up 25% of your brain power sectioning your life out, such as when you were deciding what to wear when you left your front door. Now being able to live as Gina when you're at work. You said you're a lot more focused when it comes to your job and you're just a better leader. Can you tell us more about that and what it's freed you up to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's it is one of these things, you know, as I said, like if you're spending your time sort of compartmentalizing and wondering what you can and can't tell friends and whether they might see you or all that sort of thing, what it does is it imposes a cognitive load on your brain. You have to spend time thinking about it. And insofar as you're thinking about what you might want to do in life, as I was a few years ago, as I was contemplating this, you know, these are big life decisions. And when they're big life decisions, you spend time thinking about them and they occupy your thoughts. When you don't have to think about them, it's not like I don't think about what I have to do tomorrow or what I'm going to wear to the office today, but they're very different thoughts, right? They fill up much less space and it clears up that cognitive surplus, if you like. And it allows you to focus on other things. I mean, it's one of the best arguments for officers to help people transition and be open about their gender or they're open about their sexual orientation, which is that you get better productivity because they're not spending their time thinking about these things. Now they can just spend their time thinking about work, or at least you hope they're thinking about work.
I just wanted to pick up on the whole notion of management, and what you said there in terms of productivity is really interesting, but you've spent a lot of your recent career overseeing global teams covering some of the biggest stories in recent decades. Our paths have crossed in the past, and you were, when you were particularly responsible for safety. Safety is so often seen through a very traditional white male lens. How important is it that we have more nuanced conversations about safety and the hostility faced perhaps by journalists with different backgrounds?
It's a huge issue, right? And I'm really proud to say, I mean, I'm not Reuters anymore, but I'm really proud to say that Reuters, I think, has really come along. And this was not my doing. As I've left, Reuters has brought in a safety trainer who's a woman who's, you know, both been ex-military as well as a freelance photographer. And she's set up training courses that are very much based on the idea that there are different threats to people based on their identity. And whether that's women in a war zone, or that's a person of color covering, say, a white supremacy protest. They're different vectors of threats, and it varies depending on who you are. And so having that lens with her has been really helpful, and she's going to help Reuters, you know, revamp some of their training. But it's been a really important thing, and I think that the industry has moved quite a long ways. The industry's moved along in terms of freelancers. It's moved along in terms of understanding the online threats, which are generally much more heavily directed at women and minorities. It's a really big issue. I think, you know, if you go back maybe 10 or 20 years ago, it was very much sort of ex-military, you know, a lot of emphasis on physical security, a lot of emphasis on war zones. And I think now things have changed very much. And at Reuters, we had revamped our training to cover a much broader range of threats, from, you know, civil unrest to wildfires to natural disasters and so on. And getting a big holistic sense of all of the ways that journalists can get hurt, you know, doing their job, including in terms of mental health.
I was just going to pick up on that idea, actually, because I think safety means many different things to different people, doesn't it? So, for instance, journalists who may have covered Black Lives Matter, journalists who may cover certain stories where they feel a little bit perhaps like they're the intermediary between their communities and newsrooms. There's so much of kind of that sense of perceptions around safety differing based on people's perspectives, but also that intersecting area where mental health, physical safety and online safety is, they're all part of the same conversation now in a way that I don't think they were in the past.
No, I mean, mental health has come to the fore in a huge way, probably in the last 5 to 8 years, and probably should have come to the fore much earlier, but really only probably in the last, you know, seriously in the last, certainly in the Trump years, I think as people started to understand that you could be just as damaged, I guess would be another way of putting it, or just as hurt or traumatized through that kind of non-physical aggression. And frankly, sometimes just incidentally through non-physical means, you know, that there's the whole notion of vicarious trauma and the video editors who are looking at horrific images all day long and how that affects them. So I think, you know, it's a big, frankly, new field that organizations are grappling with. And it's a really, really tricky one. I mean, I think everyone feels and understands they have moral responsibilities towards their staff who do these activities and can be hurt. But it's very hard to both mitigate against it. It's very hard to understand where the boundaries between, you know, workplace trauma, if you like, and personal life intersect. And it's just incredibly complicated. I mean, if you think about physical injuries, you know, I send you into a war zone and you receive some horrific injury while you're there, it's very clear that you got that injury because I sent you into a war zone, and I certainly have the moral responsibility of caring for you, you know, over the long term, because this is a permanent injury, right? If you're covering something and you suffer, if you like, mental health issues or mental trauma, it's never really entirely clear how that came to be. Are there issues in your personal life that might have triggered that? Was it the coverage? What was the combination of the two? I mean, and I'm not suggesting that organizations aren't responsible in some ways. I'm simply saying that because it is such a big and somewhat amorphous area, it becomes something very difficult both for the journalists and for the organizations to deal with.
It's hard enough dealing with this at any news organization, but at Reuters, on top of safety, you're in charge of logistics, budget, 2,500 journalists across 200 locations. We were talking about just boundaries just there in the pandemic. You've got all of that kind of thrown in. How did you navigate the competing demands of management? And I worked at the Wall Street Journal a little bit after you, so I've worked at a global organization where there's lots of politics going around. Heavens above, there's lots of time zones going on. How did you manage it?
I honestly, I had a really, really good team and they did all the work. I just had to sit there and play postal clerk and take credit. I really did have a fantastic team of about a dozen people spread across the world, and they managed everything. I mean, I remember a meeting in London just before the pandemic really took off, and it was just confined to China at the time. And we were working out what we needed to do and sort of figure out what would happen if, you know, God forbid, this suddenly became a global thing, you know, all the way from, you know, what offices would we have to try and keep open, how would we do that, where was our critical infrastructure, all the way to telling my poor security guy that he had to source about 30,000 N95 masks in the face of a global shortage, plus full body suits and gloves and everything. And he did it, by the way, so it's very impressive, very impressive organization. But I mean, look, the broader question really is that, you know, newsroom operations really do matter. I mean, they matter because it's not just the question of, you know, let's go out and do some great stories. It's, you know, how do you get there? How do you get in? How do you get out? How are you safe? And if this is a plea for, you know, news organizations to take these things more seriously, it's not something that you leave to all the people you don't like in the finance department or anything else. It is really a critical part of it. I have a slightly different view of journalism, I think, than most other people, partly because I've spent so much of my time in operations. But even when I was, you know, an editor-in-chief of the South China Morning Post and the Asian Wall Street Journal, I've always looked at that as a resource question as much as anything else at a certain level, which is you get good people, you put them in the right place, you think about how they get supported, and generally speaking, that ends up well, or at least it ends up better than if you didn't spend time thinking about that and all you did was spend your time trying to talk to them about stories. They'll get the stories if you put them in the right place and you give them the support that you need.
This idea about resourcing is so interesting, because we're seeing so many organizations, people feeling under pressure because of resources being squashed and yet being asked to do more. And it's such an interesting kind of idea that you reframe it in that way. But you talk then about getting people into places and then getting people out of places safely. I've been having conversations recently around Ukraine and getting teams in and out of there, and that idea that sometimes managers have to make the decisions that journalists don't like, so pulling them out at a time when a journalist might not want to leave. How do you go about doing that?
with difficulty. You know, look, different organizations have different philosophies. At Reuters, certainly the philosophy was there are really kind of two parties to any story. There's the journalist and there's their manager, and both parties have a veto. If I say there's a story and we'd like you to go, and you say, I don't want to go, it's too dangerous, then you don't go, and there are no consequences for that. On the other hand, if you say you really want to go, and I say it's too dangerous, then I really don't care how badly you want to do the story, you're coming out. That takes culture, and that takes training. And when I took over the security portfolio, which is probably about 8 years ago, there was a process of building up both the structure and I guess the workflow for approving sensitive or hazardous deployments. And then there was a process of cultural change. It probably took a few years to get that done. So, you know, at Reuters, every potentially hazardous assignment is flagged up, and we've trained people to recognize where the threshold is, if you like, what the risk appetite of the organization is. And then it gets evaluated by a team that used to work under me, and it still exists, you know, and they do a security assessment. And then there's a discussion about whether that goes forward. And if it is a significantly hazardous assignment, that gets discussed with the editor-in-chief at a regular meeting, you know, and that decision gets made all the way at the top, because certainly the organization takes safety and well-being really seriously. So it can be done, but it takes years of work to get people to all agree and sign on to it.
And it takes time building those relationships, I guess, as well, of trust, in terms of, you know, the trust at all levels of the organization too. When you were talking a little bit earlier on, you mentioned vicarious trauma. At the moment at Headlines Network, we're having a lot of conversations with people, getting requests from journalists for support around vicarious trauma or dealing with the risk of vicarious trauma. Post-pandemic, or if we can call it post-pandemic, I guess we can't really quite yet, and with the war in Ukraine still going on, there seems to be lots of other things we need to consider around vicarious trauma. How do you feel we can better support those at risk of that?
Vicarious trauma is one of the most, I think, one of the most difficult things to deal with. You know, if you think about other kinds of risks, physical risks, you can just say, we're not going there, we're not doing that. And of course, there are consequences to doing that, there's downsides to doing that. But you can, as an organization, decide what level of risk you want. You know, when it comes to sort of online abuse and trolling, again, you can make some decisions, sometimes, not always, but you can make some decisions to stay away from those areas. And that leads to other sorts of questions about self-censorship and so on. But you can kind of stay, you can minimize those things. You can get your people off social media. Often that's helpful. Vicarious trauma is a difficult issue, because if you as an organization need to, you know, have as an area of coverage certain types of images, certain types of words, certain types of stories, you're the buffer between that material and your audience. You're making the decision that this material is both authentic and important, and as well as something your audience needs to know about. And the only way you do that is by looking at it yourself. And if simply looking at something can cause you harm, then every time you do that, and sometimes you don't even know in advance before you look at it that it will cause you harm. I mean, imagine a world where we said to you, you can't interview a whole range of people because that will do you harm, or you can't pick up the phone because picking up the phone might cause you harm. That's the situation with vicarious trauma. You click on a link, you open something, there's a visual you need to look at, or there's an account you need to read, or a testimony you need to hear, and it can affect you. And the only way you can deal with that is to, I think, at this point, is to reduce the amount of exposure, to take breaks, to share it around with people. But at the end of the day, if there's 10 videos that have to be watched, they're 10 videos that have to be watched. You can spread them over 10 people, so it's not one person. You can spread them over 20 people. You can spread them over 10 days, but they're still being watched by somebody at the end of it all.
So I guess quite a few people talk about this idea of an emotional flak jacket. You know, we send people into war zones with the kind of physical flak jacket. So in terms of vicarious trauma terms, there are some things we can do to prepare people I suppose, in advance for what they might be about to see. Is that kind of what you're saying? It's part and parcel of the job, particularly for a news agency, I'm guessing. But there is stuff you can do to steal people and kind of prepare them and assess risk in advance.
Yeah, there's been a lot of work around mindfulness training and things like meditation and finding space for yourself and being more mentally prepared. Certainly, I mean, some of this is obvious. Right. I mean, if you're going through, if you're going through a messy divorce, you're probably not in the best state of mind to be looking at certain types of videos. And you probably should not be asked to do that. Or you should certainly tell people that you're not in a position to do that. But beyond that, right, in your ordinary day to day life, you can, and I've been told this, and I have not personally managed to pull this off myself particularly well, but you can do mindfulness exercises. You can learn to be more, I don't know what the right words are, present in yourself. You can meditate. I don't meditate. I tried doing Tai Chi without much success. What I do is I draw. And I did that at the, just slightly pre-pandemic because I really needed to think. And it turns out, as I now understand it, I used to think of meditation as clearing your mind of things so that, you would be, whatever the right word is, blissful and so on. It turns out that's not the case because when I, well, at least not for me, when I tried to meditate, it'd be like, my leg itches and why is that fly around and so on. But when I draw, and admittedly I haven't drawn for about 3 months now because I'm really busy, when I draw, time just stops for you. I was a very good professor I had at university, Mihail, I think Csikszentmihalyi, I could never pronounce his last name. He wrote a book called Flow. And flow is when you are so engrossed in activity that you don't realize time. And you look up and it's 8 hours later and you've forgotten to eat. And drawing is like that for me. 2-3 hours of complete immersion. You can't think because your brain is fully occupied with one thing. And I think it's been fantastic for me through the pandemic. And if you don't want to meditate or you don't want to, sit in lotus positions or do yoga, I think finding that activity, whether it's just a hobby or whatever it is, finding that activity that so fills your mind, I think is one of the ways you can help prepare yourself for the rigors of the world.
Absolutely. This is what Hannah and I kind of advocate. Just find your thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Find your thing. What as you said, either transports you or brings you back into the moment. Just with that in mind, have you detected a shift in conversations in the journalism industry around mental health since the pandemic?
Oh, absolutely. It is so much more a part of the regular conversation. It's even in sort of, I guess what you'd say, like online, stodgy legacy organizations, I think, have really embraced the idea that mental health really matters. And the pandemic has been fairly instrumental in that. If you were a senior news executive and you were sitting in your nice office and, wondering what you had for dinner tonight while your staff were out covering riots or in war zones or getting trolled, I mean, it's easy for you to have a distance from them. I think when you start wondering whether, how your children are doing because they've been stuck at home and they haven't seen their friends for ages, or depending on what country you're in, right, you weren't allowed to see friends or you weren't allowed to go out or you were, that the world suddenly had become a much more threatening place and that you were suddenly looking at that table in the restaurant that you were not sure whether you should eat in. I think it brings it much more vicariously home to you. And I think you start to understand what else everyone might be thinking about. I mean, it's a bit sad to say, but of course all politics is local and everyone really kind of identifies with what they identify with. And the pandemic in that sense has been the great leveler of mental health issues for people.
I just want to step away from mental health at the moment, but perhaps pick up on some of the things you've just mentioned. You've made it part of your mission to bring innovation into journalism, to mentor young journalists. You received an award last year from the Online News Association, the Impact Award, and now you've got this brand new job, which quite frankly is incredibly innovative, and this new role at Semaphore. How did that come about and what attracted you to that new role?
Well, it's not that difficult, actually. I mean, look, I love Reuters. I've been there for closing on 11 years, had a really nice job, great relationship with Alessandro Galloni, the new editor-in-chief, well, not new anymore, but, the then new editor-in-chief. And, I could have stayed there for a long time, but I I turned 61. And so I really was starting to think, what's my next adventure? What's my next sprint going to be? And I thought the sense was, if I stayed at Reuters, I would stay there a long time. And there's nothing wrong with that. That would have been a fine thing to do and probably play out a huge, bigger chunk of my career there. But I thought, I would like to explore and do some different things. And when Ben Smith came by, it just became a really kind of attractive notion. Never done a startup. This is really interesting. Get to build something from the ground up. As I've said to everybody, I just want to make my own mistakes. I don't want to spend my time fixing things that not mistakes, but decisions that were made, 20 years ago that were right at the time are no longer optimal, need to be looked at. And I just want to be the person that makes those mistakes so that, 30 years from now, someone can come and say, my God, what was she thinking? That's what I want to do. I want to be responsible for somebody else's angst.
It's going to be fascinating seeing how Semaphore develops. What I wanted to ask about was, we often talk about the mental health of journalists in the newsroom, but we often forget about the freelancers who are often the scaffolding which keeps these august news organisations standing still. Tell us about your thoughts around freelancers and how they're kind of often forgotten in the mix.
Yeah, I can talk. I mean, and I want to talk about another group too, which may not get as much sympathy, but managers as well. But let me come to that in a second. So yeah. Freelancers, yeah. Absolutely. And again, I think the conversation has turned on that quite a bit. I mean, there was a wonderful organization set up called ACOS, a culture of safety, which has been instrumental in getting news organizations to think much more seriously about the care and training of freelancers. And certainly at Reuters, and we were one of the first signatories to that, there's always been this sense that we need to treat freelancers for the purposes of safety as if they were staff. And there's been a whole set of processes and procedures built around that. Reuters trains all its freelancers that are going to go into hostile environments. They get access to all the same mental health resources afterwards. They get the right, as do all the journalists, to turn down assignments that are too dangerous. Reuters will not send a freelancer into a hostile environment if they have not been adequately trained for that and will simply just not take it. And if a freelancer takes an image, say, or does a story and sends it up on spec, and Reuters determines that too many risks were taken in the act of getting that image, they just won't buy it. Doesn't matter how good it is. They'll simply say, if we buy it, it just means we're winking and nodding. We're telling you you can't do this, but you send us this great photo of this bomb going off right next to you, and of course we'll buy it. What that does is it encourages you to do it again, and the answer is like, well, no, we won't do that. You ignored the instructions about safety, and that's not acceptable. So I'm really proud of what Reuters has done, but it's not just Reuters. Obviously, lots and lots of organizations have shifted in this direction. I think I credit ACOS with doing some fantastic work in shifting that mindset, because it's not really ultimately all that difficult to actually do. What it does requires for people to think of those people for the time that they work for you as working for you and as deserving of care as all the other people. The other part, which I just wanted to sort of get through as well, is just to say that, and this is something that Joel Simon, who recently left the Committee of Peck Journalists, and I had a discussion about, which is that in an age of much better communication and real-time knowledge and location tracking and so on, managers in newsrooms have a much better sense of what their staff are doing and where they are. And now many more of them are being pulled into real-time discussions about what is safe and what is not safe. And, and it used to be one of these things where you would say like, okay, we've done the safety assessment. It's fine for you to go to Kyiv right when you're there and tell us what's happening. And now we know where they are. And now we know where they are on a minute-by-minute basis. And managers are much more pulled into making those decisions. In some cases, they're not as well trained as they should be for that. But I also think about the mental health issues for them as they are sitting and really thinking about, I've just made this decision and this person's, stepping out into that street. Did I do the right thing? And I think that increasingly as we all sort of move into that connected world, that mental health and that training needs to extend across the entire organization, not just to frontline reporters and freelancers.
It's so interesting you mentioned that, because that's something that we've detected, and it's something that we're working on at the moment in terms of trying to create training to support managers to be able to both look after themselves, but also have conversations with colleagues around how they are and how they really are. I think that, you know, a lot of the time we talk about the fact that journalists are journalism's most precious resource. And actually, you know, the empathy that we show people whose stories we tell and share needs to kind of be turned back on ourselves a little bit more. This is a question we ask all of our guests, and it has various different answers, I suppose. But we ask everyone why journalism matters to them. And a lot of the time these conversations around humanity and empathy does come up. So why does journalism matter to you?
Oh, God, so many different reasons. I mean, first of all, you just have to understand that I'm not a people person. I'm somewhere in the Asperger scale, so I really hate people. People are not my thing. I like information. It's different. I'm very nerdy. But, you know, why does journalism matter? I mean, it matters because the world needs information, and you can't depend on other industries, I guess, to give it to you, and that you need to do it with a sense of mission, not necessarily with a sense of, I don't know what the right word is, product. And I think that's a really important service to the world. And I think one of the things that journalism really should do is go back to its roots of serving communities. I think sometimes we get too enamored of the content we produce, and that we think it's great, I did this story. And I think it needs to be better connected to, I helped this community, you know, learn things they needed to learn, or, you know, make better decisions. And I think that's something that's important for the industry as a whole to embrace.
I'm really interested by that idea of serving communities. And having heard you speaking with us, perhaps it's difficult for me to separate that from the notion of you as a role model in media, and you as doing this kind of work and finding this identity. How important is it that you are a role model within media?
I don't know how much of a role model I am. I think my role model is that I didn't get fired. So like, well, that's an achievement right there. I think there's a few different things. One is, yes, I think it's useful to be able to have people who can look up and say this. There are other people like me in the industry, and they've managed for some time in the same way that I looked up and I saw people who were role models to me, and whose shoulders, as I say, you know, we all step on. I think that's really important. But I do think it's, you know, representation is important. I think people need to have that visibility so that they can feel like it's something they can achieve. But I think it's, newsrooms need to do more than that. And I think that newsrooms need to really cultivate this sensitivity towards multiple points of view. I don't think it's fair, and I've said this before too, it's like, you know, if Reuters, when I was at Reuters, was doing a story about trans people, I don't think it's fair for them to come to me and say, you know, we're doing this story, what do you think? It's not fair to me. I don't represent the community. It's not fair to the community. I don't represent the community. And fundamentally, it's not fair to Reuters. It's not fair to the readers. What we need to do as an industry is we need everyone to be understanding enough that there are multiple points of view on a story, and their perspectives that should be at least listened to, and that editors and reporters need to understand who they can go to, and it's not me, to understand those perspectives. We all need to do a better job on that.
Finally, Gina, we all ask our interviewees just one piece of advice, mental health advice that they have. You talked about mindfulness and drawing before. Do you have one piece of advice for our audience in terms of managing their mental health?
I believe that mental health is often driven out of purpose. And even if you don't have time to draw, even if you are, you know, you're working 18 hours a day and you're flat out, I think if you have a sense of mission, if it's not a job, if you understand what the outcome is, if you understand what presumably good you are doing, I think it helps you get through a lot of things. It doesn't get you through everything, and it doesn't get you through everything forever. And you do need to take those breaks, and you do need to find that moment of zen in you. But if you don't start with a sense of purpose, and you're not sure why you're in this business, then maybe you should ask yourself why you're in this business. Having a North Star, I think, really gets you out of bed every day, really gives you a reason to get through all of the things you are going to have to deal with in that day, most of which will not be pleasant, and much of which will not be apparent as part of your North Star. But I think if you can connect those things, I think you give yourself a sense of achievement. There was that story, which is probably apocryphal, where John F. Kennedy goes to Cape Canaveral, as it was then called, because they didn't name it after him till he died. And he says to a janitor, "What are you? You know, what's your job?" And he says, "I'm putting a man on the moon." And that's, I think, what we really have to keep in mind. We are making the world a better place, and we have to hold that as our North Star.
Gina, thank you ever so much for joining us.
So find your North Star. What a great guiding principle to have there from Gina. Just her talking about her own personal story during the pandemic and what she's done was an inspiration.
Just that sense of purpose that clearly drives her forwards and onwards, all that she said about how journalism matters and that kind of need to stand by that sense of purpose to support us as journalists to do our jobs well and to do our jobs better.
And our sense of purpose, Hannah, is to keep these conversations going through these podcasts. You'll find us on all the usual channels, so we look forward to joining you soon.